welcome to another episode of Confessions of a Wee Tim Rasbushi. This is your host, Menion, also known as Rob.
Hey Rob, Jason here. Listen to your latest and last episode for OSR October and your musings on pantheons and whatnot. I think picking a pantheon from deities and demigods is a good way to go. Now, some of the pantheons are better developed than others and better balanced. I don't know if balanced is the right word, but more fleshed out and have a little bit nuance than others. But I think that's a good way to go. I would definitely change all the names. I wouldn't drop in the Babylonian pantheon and keep all the names. But if you change all the names around, the game, when we look at it, has already changed these deities up a fair bit. So I think once you change the names and maybe adjust another thing or two, you're pretty far away from that. And so I don't think it's really cultural appropriation at that point. And I think you're okay using that as inspiration for your pantheon. And it saves you a heck of a lot of work. I like the idea you talk about how, like, Mount Olympus, the adventurers could reach Mount Olympus. And the same thing when you think about the Greeks, you could reach the underworld as well, right? Traveling to try to save somebody from the realm of the dead, or at least visit them in the realm of the dead. And we see this also in other mythologies, like, well, although it's not real world mythologies, but in the, at least in the comic books, you could travel to the mountain where Crom lives in the Conan books. So that was a possibility in the Marvel comics. So I like the idea of being able to reach to where these gods live sometimes. The idea of being able to, for the underwater deities, for the various water-based creatures, having a way you could travel between the ocean and wherever that deity lives, I think is a good way to go as well. So, really great ideas. I look forward to seeing what you flesh out. Hey Rob, so I finished your last episode of OSR October. And I'm very interested to see where your die pool system goes. I always had more of a fondness for percentile dice. You know, of course, the proper kind, D20s marked 0 to 9 twice. But I have a preference for percentile dice over D6s and die pools. But that doesn't mean it's not interesting. I'm not curious to see where it goes. And as you state, there are advantages to it. Target numbers are both a good and a bad thing for me. I like the idea of target numbers, but I don't necessarily like setting them on the fly, and you can't have everything already figured out what the target number is going to be. So that's the only possible downside of target number. Of course, you can set it on the fly. It's just not my favorite thing to do, because then you always second guess yourself. Did I make that too hard? Did I make it too easy? That kind of thing. But all in all, very interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing where the system goes. Thank you so much for all your OSR October shows, and I look forward to seeing what you do in the future.
Thank you very much, Jason, for those comments. First, dealing with the discussion of gods, yeah, I like the idea of just appropriating. That's not the right word, is it, in this discussion? But utilizing the gods of a certain world mythos, for example, the Sumerian or Babylonian gods, and just changing some of the names around, and there you've got a classic set of deities that represent law and chaos, for example, or something like that. In a more abstract kind of setting, something like the new, I don't know how to pronounce this, but, you know, Fritz Leiber's, I don't know how to pronounce that either. Mythos, gods like hate and so on. The gods of Lankmar, very evocative, brilliant pictures, right? So those kinds of deities are almost more like demigods. They are something that are very clearly in the world and part of the world, or at least they've got a toehold in the world. And they're not like these big, powerful deities or archetype like deities of Greek mythology, but something a little bit more demonic, maybe is the right word. I don't know, something a little bit more like powerful entities from another world, powerful entities, but ones that aren't all powerful, all seeing, almighty, you know. Anyway, yeah, that's all I have to say about the gods for now. As for your comments on the dice pool, so-called dice pool system, yeah, it's a tricky one. Brian Bloodaxe on Twitter, so-called Twitter X, whatever it's called now, and Blue Sky commented that he doesn't really like, you know, having those dice, and he feels that it really creates a system where the players can game the rules, I think is the term we use, something about gaming it, gaming the system. You know, it is a game, so we do want to be able to game it to us in certain ways, but I suppose he just feels that people can then sort of look at their stats and use those to lever. I don't know if I'm putting words in his mouth, but use those to lever the action of the adventure, giving the stats much more power maybe than other elements of the game. I don't know where I stand on this. I was very excited about it, and I think the most, for me, the important part, the reason why I addressed that in the last episode was that I just, you know, those stats, they're so much fun, right? But trying to get those stats, those numbers, to mean something more than what is completely abstract is a puzzle that has given me no end of many people a lot of trouble. I mean, we can see the game designers at TSR back in the day with the skill set that was first introduced in the Gazetteer, and then later in the Rules Cyclopedia for Dungeons and Dragons, and also in the first edition of Dungeons and Dragons, becoming much more formalized in the second edition, in the form of non-weapon proficiency skills. You know, they tied, I think Oriental Adventures, actually, of the first edition, was the one that really first brought in these skills, other than those that were being used for the thief and so on. But in Oriental Adventures, it wasn't tied to the stats, right? So that's kind of slightly different. They were base numbers, and you could improve those numbers. But with Wilderness Survival Guide, the Dungeoneer Survival Guide, we first get an attempt to tie skills to stats using that skill number or a modified skill number, and then trying to roll under. Similarly, third edition, fifth edition, we have the stat, or at least only, well, not actually the stat anymore, the ability modifiers, because the ability modifiers are standardized, like in basic D&D. You can then use those to modify a D20 roll and try to hit a target number. Obviously, you're not a big fan of target numbers. Now, this is something that was not invented by Wizards of the Coast, in my opinion. I think the basic idea, it's not quite the same, but the basic idea that they are tapping into there is something that came up first in Talislanta, and perhaps some of you know other games that actually came up with it, but Talislanta is the one that stands out to me for being the game that used the D20 with a kind of proficiency bonus and ability bonuses, and that added onto a number. Now, the point where Talislanta exceeds D&D is that the successes are graduated, similar to what you see in a similar way as you see in Middle-earth role-playing. So you can have a fumble, you can have a failure, you can have a partial success, you can have a success, and you can have a critical success. Possibly the names were a little different, but you get the idea. So you weren't hitting a target number. That's different, fair enough. You're trying to get a success. The difficulty of that action will be modified depending on the circumstances, right? So it's a lot of it actually works out very similar to D&D, but the way they've gone about it is different. Of course, in Talislanta, again, you don't have stats anymore, as in a like 3 to 18 range. It is only a modifier by that time. So yeah, I think Talislanta was way ahead of a lot of these games, and I still think it does it better than most of them. But then I have to say, I've only played, you know, so many sessions of Talislanta, and that was a long time ago. Apologies for the sound. That's our little vacuum robot collecting information for the corporations and government about our homes and beaming it back. Well, maybe, who knows? I think the new models can do that. All right. So thank you once more for that. Those two messages ran together, and let's see what else I've got. Okay, so I'm going to do a little review of a game that you probably won't play, or maybe you will. This is a Japanese role-playing game called Sword World 2.5, and I may have mentioned it before a couple of times. I own the books, well, I own a lot of the books going back to the first edition as well. But the 2.5 is the current edition. And what I'm going to look at today is one of the RPG starter sets for this game. And it's called Hoshi wo Tsukamu Meikyu. Okay, I think I got that right. Meikyu, a labyrinth. So yeah, literally, it is the labyrinth that reaches for the stars, I guess. Or the maze, or the dungeon grasping at the star or stars. And it is a starter set, of course, on the side of the box. Well, let me just describe the box a little bit. It is, using my eyes, it's about 6 or 7 inches by 5 inches. About 7 inches by 5 inches. Centimeters, I've got a centimeter ruler, not an inch ruler. So that's just over 19 centimeters long. And it's, you know, about 13... it's about 14, just nearly 14 centimeters wide. And you've got, you've got about just over four centimeters depth. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is pretty chunky. So it's a very tough box. It's got what I consider a very nice fantasy art on the cover. And it's got the little images on the sides. So we've got the logo, the various logos, the name of the product and stuff. The company, which is Group SNE, a leading role-playing company in Japan. And the picture is a scene inside a labyrinth. Center is a man, a knight. Looks like a fighter. Yeah, he's got a buckler. And in that hand of the buckler, where he's got the buckler, he's also grasping a torch. Very good. I like that use of the buckler. He's also got what looks like a long sword, and he's wearing plate armor, decent sturdy boots. Yeah, this isn't the typical kind of Japanese anime style fantasy art that you might be accustomed to. This is a little bit more gritty looking. Very nice. In the background, so as I said, it's a dungeon. As you can see, that they've come down some stairs. There's a party of four of them. Other than the fighter, who is looking around with his torch held high, you have a dwarf dressed in splint mail. He's got a hammer, a shield slung over his back. There's also wearing lamellar armor or plate armor or something. You've got a wolf-headed creature. This is a lycanth, I believe they're called, which is a, you know, like a lycanthrope. They're generally, I think, they they're werewolves or were creatures, and they have different forms. This one's in the animal, part animal form. He's got a bow slung on his back and maybe a sword at his side. He's, I say he, I think it is a he, you can't tell in the picture though, is checking the chest, treasure chest. And there's an elf, looks like a maid. She's clutching a wand and she's examining some kind of depiction, which looks like a diagram of some kind. She is not, yeah, she's wearing a long robe, as functional as that is for the exploring of dungeons. It is at least fully covering her body. She's not exposing leg and stuff, as is the typical, has often been the case in fantasy. Yeah, these characters actually appear in the adventure. So yeah, that Lycant is called, I don't know what he's called. The dwarf is called Dog or something like that. And the fighter is called Alt. Anyway, these are the pre-gen characters. And pictures of each one of the characters, the elf, the dwarf, the Lycant, and the human fighter, are on the side panels of the box, right? On the back, we have, we've got a picture, illustrated sort of contents of the box, what you get inside the box. Again, this is all in colour. And you can see there are some items, maps, and so on. I'll go into a little bit more detail in a moment. All right, so let me continue. Where was I? I was looking at the back of the box, and I'm just going to, instead of opening up and spreading everything out, because there's a lot of pieces, I'm going to look at a photo that I took the other day, because it shows everything that was in the box. So the box is packed, right? And I should also mention, this is a solid box. I mean, one of the things Japan does well is create paper and card and so on. You pick it up and it just slides out very, very slowly. I mean, it's not quite as solid as the old school essentials box set that old the Necrotic Gnome did, but it is solid. It's very solid, and if you consider the price, yeah, they put a lot of money into the packaging and the items themselves. So what do you get, right? That's what you want to know. You get four booklets. Okay, you get a rule booklet, which gives you all the basic rules that you'll need to play these adventures, and there are adventures in here. There's a start book. Now, the start book says, if you want, you can skip everything else and just start with this. You don't need to read the rules because we're going to explain it inside. That's fantastic. The start book has a solo adventure. It tells you all the pieces you need, and also shows you what you'll need to play this solo adventure. And yeah, it's a full, a very simple adventure. I'll probably describe it a little bit more in a moment, but let me go on to the other pieces that you get first. So yeah, you get those four booklets. The other two booklets, by the way, are, is it three booklets? Ooh. There's three scenarios, basically, in addition to the solo adventure. So you're getting a number of adventures, so you can play through this and decide, is this system for us? Do we like this game, right? Very good. You get monster cards with pictures on one side and the stats on the other of all the monsters that you will meet in any of the adventures. Now, one feature of this game is that there's a monster recognition roll, and particularly if you're a sage, if you have levels in the sage class, which is more like classes in this are really they're a toolbox of various skills, right? And you can have multiple classes, so you could be level two sorcerer and a level one sage. And in fact, taking levels in sage actually helps your progression as a sorcerer. But that's not part of these rules. These are, you know, just very much more basic and trimmed down. So you have those monster cards. You have character cards, which are laying flat on the table. They have a picture, they have your stats laid out in a way that's fairly clear. And you also have equipment cards, which are narrow pieces of cards, which can be placed to the on the bottom side or the right-hand side of the card. So you put the right armor shields on the right-hand side, and you can put the little equipment weapon card on the bottom. And these then align with your stats to show your modified attack or defense numbers and so on. So it's really nice way of doing a character sheet for a beginner. It's not the main game, you've got a standard character sheet, but this kind of system, when you've got pre-gens, and the card is quite nice. It's not this flippy, flimsy card. It's not paper. It's a solid card with a nice hard finish, and a gloss hard finish. What else we got here? We have eight dice, 8d6. So the game is played using 2d6 generally. Most rolls are use 2d6, and you've got one set for everybody, I believe. 1, 2, 3. Oh no, we've got 10d6. Wow, okay, we've got 10d6 because they're assuming up to 4 players and 1 GM. You have, similarly, you have 5. Goodness, what do you call these? You have 5 whiteboard pens. There we go. Because you actually get, in addition to the character cards, you get similar sized whiteboards, whiteboard cards that can be handed out to everybody. So these whiteboard cards can then be used to write down your hit points, treasure, whatever. So instead of having paper and pencil, you've got that and you can reuse it. Interesting idea. I like that. Then you have, I don't know how many. There must be like 10 or 12 cards. Now, there's loads of equipment cards. There's quite a few monster cards, actually. And the character cards, there are not exactly one each. So there's 4 characters, but there's also to show how the characters are progressing. They actually level up, and they've actually done the leveling up for you. So there are the pre-gens have multiple cards for the same character. Anyway, I was talking about these 10 or 12 cards. These have little counters for your character cards, some counters for the monsters, and also some special effects and map cards. They're not to scale, but they give you a kind of general layout of what you're looking at. So that's quite a nice little feature. And one other feature is that on the back of the rule books, the various books or scenario books, you've also got the basic combat layout. So in the basic, there's basic, there's intermediate and advanced combat rules. In the basic combat, you're basically in the rear. So we have two rears. We have the attacker's rear, we've got the defender's rear, and you've got the center ground where they meet. And depending on if you get the initiative or not, you get to place. You could stay in the rear, stay back, or you can move forward into a combative mode. Now, if they don't move, then into the monsters don't place anything in the combative mode, you can then actually move into their rear and start attacking them there. And this has an impact on spell casting, ranged weapons, and so on. But generally, you need to have more twice the number of attackers if you wish to bypass the 4, the vanguard, I guess, is that the word? The vanguard, the front rank, and then move into the back ranks and attack them. So generally, that's probably not going to happen in most games. But if there's more monsters, that can happen. And this is where you need the counters. So you place those in that on that just to get a general understanding of who's in the rear, who's not. Okay, but otherwise, you can't sort of just jump to the back and start stabbing and stuff. You have to be able to move through the middle ground, as it were. So that's the basic combat rule layout. It gets much more complicated with actual distances and three dimensions. But this one is one dimensional combat. Yeah, one dimensional, and then it builds on two dimensions, and it goes into three dimensions. I guess that's probably enough information there. So yeah, I've got all these cards. They're actually pop out without any hassle, and you can pop them back in, which is something I really like. So you can, it will fit snugly back into the box. So if you've used the some map pieces and some monster pieces, you can actually place them back into the original kind of backing card, and pack it away again. Lovely. And that is everything you get in the box. Oh no, there's one more thing you get. In addition to the character cards, you get what are double-sided kind of fold-out sheets, glossy kind of paper, magazine-type paper sheets. Again, with a larger picture this time of the character, their background, and a description of their abilities and how to use them. So that's what you get. You get these adventures. They look pretty solid. The solo adventure, I'll just say a few things about it before letting you off. The solo adventure could have been a little bit more padded out, I think. But for what it is a good introduction to the dice system, the core mechanic, which is to determine whether you've succeeded using 2d6 and you add, how to add your modifiers, how to subtract modifiers, and what you're rolling against if it's an opposed roll, as it is in combat. And that's it, really. And it says that you've been, while looking in the equipment shop or something, your character is approached or sees a poster or something saying that a goblin has been spotted in the local caves, and there's a 100 gemel, which is the currency reward for getting rid of the offending goblin. Very, very simple. Starts you off at the in the cave, and there's actually a door inside the cave, and you're at the approaching the door, so it gives you the chance to see if you can hear anything, to check for traps, right? So you're learning how to do the rules. And then you can also try and pick the lock because you've got your fighter, you're playing the fighter, and you have one rank in scout. And I think you probably have some lock picks or something like that in your equipment list. Anyway, whether you're successful or not, you go into the room, or the goblin comes out, and a fight ensues, and then you get to practice the combat rules. The combat, again, the basic rules are very simple, and typical monsters, they're not rolling dice. They have a base attack and a base defense, and we're not rolling against each other. The players roll all the dice, so they have to roll their defense against the monster's attack. Otherwise the monster hits them, right? And the only thing I would then roll would be the damage, although possibly that's set as well. Anyway, it's quite a nice system. For bosses or more important fights, you can roll all the dice are there, so instead of having the monster's fixed numbers, you can actually roll them, just, and that makes a more swingy encounter, a bit more excitement when that excitement is needed and time is on hand. So I'm not going to go into the rules more than that. Just wanted to say that, it's a nice little purchase. It was about 3,500 yen, which may or may not be much money at the current rates. I think it's a nicely produced introduction for complete novices. People who know nothing about fantasy role playing could pick this up and be playing within minutes, and that solo adventure takes 10 minutes. And but once you've done that, presumably, I've not read the scenarios yet, but you know, occasionally referring to the rule book. You could then go to scenarios, and I think the scenarios also drip feed you the rules and how to use the magic and so on. So, you know, it looks like a really solid book. I wouldn't mind actually getting it to the table, but we'll see. We'll see if that happens. What else do I want to say? Oh, yes. So the character background sheets that I referred to earlier, I've actually got, I had two of the same one in there, and one of the one for the fighter was missing. Now, I was still able to play the solo adventure, but I immediately wrote to the company, Group SNE, which is actually just down the road in Kobe. I could actually go down and knock on their door, but I don't think they'd welcome that. I sent an email. They got back to me within the same day, apologized, and said, asked me for my details so that they could send me a replacement sheet. The missing sheet. And they just asked for, you know, some photos just to show the contents and that and what's missing. You know, really good service. So I finished that, sent that off this morning. So hopefully in the post, it's just a one little sheet, you know, hopefully something will arrive from them. That's a friendly neighborhood RPG company, Japanese RPG company. And they deal with other games as well. This is Group SNE. They deal with, this is their main game there, Sword World 2.5. They also do, I think, a game based on the older rules of Sword World that is for Goblin Slayer, the Japanese anime. And they do Lodos as well, Lodos Wars RPG. Lodos was a big anime, and originally it was a campaign run by Japanese role players using basic D&D. And they print other games as well, like they print Pugmire, which isn't a Japanese role-playing game, but yeah, it's published by Group SNE in Japan, so that's great stuff. Anyway, that's enough me rambling. Hopefully that's giving you a little bit of taste of quite an interesting little product I picked up. I should probably go through some of the other role-playing games, but you know, if you want to hear about Sword World 2.5, I can actually do a little bit more. So just give us a shout and I'll explain some of the rules and what it does. I forget if I've already done this. So I don't think I went into great detail before. I've got a lot of other Japanese role-playing games like Lodos Wars and the older versions of Sword World that I've been collecting up recently this year. So yeah, maybe that's something I can do. Anyway, thank you for listening. Right, this is me about a week later, and at least a week later from recording the initial items. A little bit more than a week, actually, about 10 days. Anyway, here I am, and I'm here because I had my fifth session of Dark Sun yesterday. And the players asked me what happened with the fourth session recap. Well, the fourth session recap, as much of the show, as with the case of much of the show, had already been recorded, but I had not added it to the show. And in fact, I'm going to add it to the next show, I think. And the next show, and we'll also have the session five recap. So I'll probably do a little Dark Sun special or something and release that together. Anyway, that is the show so far. I hope you've liked it, Sword World and so on. I have one more item, however, one more little bonus item. This is an email, and I'm going to read it out in full. It's from Ian B, who sent me a message via the email address that I use for this podcast, the Yahoo email address. And he has this to say, if I can find it. Here you go. All right, so he says, it's great that you are thinking of doing your own OD&D and Sword and Wizardry campaign in 2024 and are taking the steps now to prepare a plan. While I've been an avid reader of the old modules and some of the better ones produced by the OSR, parentheses, OSR, Gavin Norman's in particular, OSE, Old School Essentials. I've come to the conclusion that a small-scale campaign where adventures last 1 to 3 sessions is more suitable for grognards, where getting a consistent group is a task in itself. This is what I've done for my BX campaign, which, with bits of LL, Labyrinth Lord, AEC. Okay, I think that's the advanced rules for Labyrinth Lord. My campaign area, Fogthorpe, is The campaign area for Fogthorpe is 19 3-mile hexes across, just under 8 square miles per hex. 19 3 miles, I'm not sure if I'm reading that right. The terrain and contents of which were seeded using the random generators in the Mouse Ritter RPG. And this is available free at mouseritter.com, he says. These random generators cover hex contents, landmarks, major factions, NPCs and their motivations. The basic generation of this was less than 2 hours in a notebook. And then I've taken these seeds to develop the area for humans rather than anthropomorphic mice, as fun as they can be. For dungeons and random monster lairs, I've plundered the Dyson Logos free maps, all of which are small scale and explorable in 1 to 2 sessions. What this has ended up with is a campaign area which has knights and peasants, and where fairies, ogres and trolls creep out into the world from woods, barrows and knolls, giving it a folky, whimsical flavour of old England. It's not big, but it has been suitable for up to levels 4 to 5, but could be expanded by adding to the hexes as I go along. I think the players are ready for a bigger challenge than a larger multi-level dungeon would be. If I think the players are ready for a bigger challenge, then a larger multi-level dungeon would be my next step, and this can be positioned in any of the 19 hexes. One thing that I realised was that it would be nearly impossible for a party to find adventure sites in anything other than a 3-mile hex. Just reflecting on that, hidden areas and adventure sites I played as a 12-year-old tells me what most of the campaign supplements and source books are at too large a scale. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, good point. I strongly recommend the random generators in Mouse Ritter to get your small scale campaign off the ground. It's fun just even rolling up everything. The other topic I want to comment on is the attribute test. Like yourself, I used the D20 back in the day and again when I returned to the hobby in 2017. However, this flat probability always seemed a bit bland, and after thinking and experimenting with ones, I decided to just use the 2d6 mechanic, which is already embedded in the monster reactions table. The player rolls 2d6 with modifiers for the appropriate attribute and situational and professional penalties. Not many fighters do astronomy or alchemy, and not many thieves know how to organize troops for battle. If the result is uncertain, then it takes longer, one round or one turn or 1 hour, depending upon what the PC is trying to do. Before success or failure becomes apparent, scores of equal to or under 2 or equal or over 12 are major failures or successes. Unmodified snake eyes is an automatic failure, and boxcars is an automatic basic success, both of which are slightly less probable than 1 in 20 on a D20. Stat modifiers used are the charisma adjustment on a scale of -2 to +2. Okay, so he's using the BX system there. Keep up the podcast, he says, and I'm keen to know how your 2024 campaign plans will come together. No spoilers, obviously. Yeah, thank you so much, Ian, for that. I have no idea if the campaign will come together, but I will continue to plan regardless of who plays or whether it gets off the ground. So Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for listening to my awful reading of Ian's wonderful message. Thank you, Ian, for that message. And I'll talk to you again very soon. So I've got one recap for the Dark Sun campaign already in the pipeline. And I need to make another one because we just had the fifth session yesterday and it was great. So thank you so much and talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you.